From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
And this morning, Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with David Flink. He is the founder and chief empowerment officer of Eye to Eye. It's a national mentoring program for students with learning and attention issues that expands our understanding of the learning process, especially for those with dyslexia. David will be in town on August 17th to speak.
Then in our new series that explores the legacy and history of Park City as it relates to the present, we speak with local resident Jan Wilking, a longtime community leader, business person, and co-founder of Mountain Trails Foundation.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us.
Welcome to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our next guest is a renowned dyslexia expert, author and founder of Eye to Eye, a national nonprofit mentoring program, David Flink. He's the author of Thinking Differently, an inspiring guide for parents of children with learning disabilities. His expertise is partly developed by his exploration into his own learning disabilities that challenged him as a child. He's coming to Park City on August 17th to speak at the Joseph James Morelli Foundation event. David, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me, and I can't wait to be in person with everyone in a month.
Yeah, we're excited for you. Tell us a little bit about the journey that led you to be a part of the dyslexic ADHD community.
Sure. Well, like all stories, we have to begin at the beginning. And I would tell you that in elementary school, I did not know that I was going to get to be part of this incredible community that has ultimately been my life's journey. I struggled tremendously in school. I was born in 1980, so I joke sometimes it was before dyslexia was invented, but of course we know that it was a thing. And thank goodness, while I was struggling, really teachers just didn't know what to do with me. That's what was happening. They'd ask me to read out loud. I very much couldn't because they hadn't taught me to read in a way that worked with how my brain worked. And thankfully, my mom, an educator in the school that I was in, helped everyone figure it out. And I identified as having dyslexia and ADHD in fifth grade. Things really turned around. We'll talk about that when I come visit. But from about sixth grade through high school, I learned strategies that worked with how my brain worked. I ended up at Brown University, a place that my elementary school kids' brain would never have imagined, and realized that probably the thing that I struggled with most was loneliness. It is incredibly lonely to feel different and to struggle. And I realized at that point that 20% of us learn differently. So I decided I wanted to give back, and that's where I founded Eye to Eye, this program in which neurodiverse students mentor younger people who can give back.
Oh, that's wonderful. There is a lot of feelings that come up, even shame or like embarrassment. There's so many things when we're trying to figure out why we're different, and everybody's built differently. So it's such a great thing that you're doing. How would you suggest, what was the way that your mom helped the educators discover your issues, and how can parents kind of start to identify what's going on if their kid might be suffering from some of these things?
You know, I think like all parents, and you know, Mary Beth, we were quickly talking about being parents ourselves now, right before hopping on. You know, we always, as parents, we want just to do whatever we can for our kids, right? And I think what my mom realized is I was starting to act out a lot in school. I think I realized it was kind of easier to be the bad kid than it was to be the dumb kid. And she knew that wasn't who I was. And so, you know, talking to, in this case, it was many of her peers, and she taught in the same school, said, you know, this doesn't seem like David, right? The kid who's quite literally lighting fireballs in class, which is what I was doing. I had taken up a hobby as a magician. You know, that's not the kid who comes home. So something's off. And thankfully they said, well, let's just take a look under the hood. And they did have the tools back in the 80s to figure that out. And I think a lot of times parents are scared to ask the question. They don't want to know if, you know, dyslexia is part of their experience or potentially part of their kid's experience. And in fact, we know it's hereditary. So a lot of times parents have this experience and they're hiding from it because they don't want their kids to struggle. And in fact, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It both got me what I needed in terms of succeeding in school, and it gave me this incredible community.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with David Flink of I2I. It's a nonprofit that he founded, and he is now the CEO, which is the Chief Enlightenment Officer. No, what is it?
We're going to do enlightenment today. In general, it's the Chief Empowerment Officer, which I think is germane to our conversation too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's so interesting to me that even now, everything we know about dyslexia, people, including the very person for whom the Joseph James Morelli Foundation is named, didn't get a diagnosis really until so late, until your confidence is really shaken to the core. You know, elementary school, even junior high, I think it wasn't till about 10th grade when Joseph got a diagnosis of dyslexia. And how does that happen? Even though we know so much, we know so little.
It's such an important question. And, you know, I think we unpacked it a little bit in the idea that parents are scared of these words. They don't sound like exciting words. And the stories that we have often heard in the media has changed a lot. And we're doing it today. But they're scary stories. My kid has dyslexia. They're not going to be able to read. That's not true. But we think that. Or what's it going to mean if my kid reads with their ears and not their eyes? Which frankly is how my little guy who's six, that's how he loves to read. And I have no problem with that. So I think there's a lot of fear and anxiety around even asking the question. And then if the answer comes out as dyslexic or ADHD, a lot of times the mentors or the role models that we give families, they're very highfalutin and they're very far away. So when I was a kid, even after I got this diagnosis, my parents tried to dissuade my fears by saying, well, don't worry, you know, Chuck Schwab is dyslexic. And I was like, okay, who's Chuck Schwab? Why is that helpful to me? And then they say, no, forget Chuck Schwab. You don't know who that is. How about Henry Winkler? I'm like, okay, same problem. And I don't want to be an actor. So, you know, what are we doing here? So what I would tell parents and folks who are listening today is to know that there are mentors and role models in your community right now. And the way you find them is by talking about dyslexia, which of course is what the work that we're coming to in August to do together in community is to find ways to talk about our stories and to share how we get through this journey called life together.
Yes. Well, you wrote a book called Thinking Differently, an inspiring guide for parents of children with learning disabilities. And boy, oh boy, the reviews and the thankfulness with which parents comment on this book. It's they all say, of course, if only we had known this, if only we had had this book, you know, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, it would have helped so much. What are those secrets of your book?
I will give the short version now and the longer version later. So I will first say the reason why I wrote Thinking Differently was, in fact, because there was no blueprint. This is the book that I would wish my parents had had. And having sat front row center seats to families throughout the country and the world for several decades, listening to their stories, I said, I should write these stories down. So it is both my story and the story of many, many other people compiled together as a bit of a blueprint. And what it takes people through, and I can give kind of the quick headlines here, is first, what is this journey about? We already talked a little bit, you know, getting identified. What are you going to learn when that happens? If in fact your kid is a part of this club, that's okay. 20% of everybody in this world is. And what do you want to do after that? So everything from understanding if you're in the public system, what an IEP is or 504, these are ways in which you ensure your kid gets an equitable education, to what are accommodations? Why is it okay to have an accommodation like reading with your ears as opposed to reading with your eyes, which was an accommodation I had. And it goes on further to say, you know, how do we actually make this an okay part of one's identity? What comes from that? And, you know, I think, look, I don't ever use the word learning disabilities. That doesn't feel right for me. I understand in the context of school, you often need it. But this learning identity is one that you can be proud of. And it's different than, I think, other what I would call conditions. This isn't a condition in my mind. You know, my dad's diabetic. I don't think he strongly identifies as being diabetic, but I strongly identify as being dyslexic. It's part of who I am.
Yeah, it's I think that the kind of neurodiversity movement has been really helpful in people realizing that there are many, many ways that we approach the world. I remember years ago taking like a Kolbe test that talks about, are you a kinesthetic learner or visual learner, audio learner? And I think that maybe those categories could all be expanded across many ways that people learn, right? What would be a way that like who do you go to if you want to get tested to see if you're part of the dyslexic community?
Yeah, there's a fast way and a slow way, like all things, I suppose. If you're in the public system, you can, especially if your kid's struggling, you can literally go directly to the school and say, "Look, I'm requesting that my kid get identified." It can take a while, but it is a way to go. And if it's the resources that you have, then you should do that. I actually went and pushed for both my kids to get identified very early. My daughter, it turned out, was not neurodiverse. Her heart was broken. She wanted to be like your old dad. I said, "Your mom's pretty awesome too, and she's not neurodiverse, so it's okay." And then it turned out my kid, in fact, is neurodiverse. So I believe in the future, everyone deserves the right to kind of have that framework, know how you learn and think. All you're doing when you go get these tests is really a sense of, how you learn. And of course, if you're really, really concerned and you have the resources to do it, you can go privately. And sometimes insurance will even cover that. I actually, during the pandemic, I'm fortunate to be able to enroll one of my kids into a study where we were able to get for free an early identification. They wanted to test me and my kid to see if there was a genetic component. So I even got recently retested, and I was very worried that I would come back not dyslexic. It would change my entire identity and career path. I am very dyslexic, it turns out. Still, 44, nothing's changed.
I really appreciate your pride in community. I think that's awesome. Back in the day, before, like pre-80s, it seemed like I bet a lot of kids went fell through the cracks because they were seen as unintelligent or unfocused, unmotivated like that. And now we see that there are so many reasons for that. And we see that many people who are dyslexic or have ADHD are actually quite exceptionally intelligent. Do you find that there are certain groups, males, females, and is there anybody who's kind of disproportionately affected by these things?
So I'm going to unpack two of those things. I love what's in your question is both some of the strengths that come with neurodiversity and also your question about like where is identification happening. So I'll answer that second part, which is to say, if you go back in the research, they used to think, oh, certain tendencies overrepresent here or there. It's not the case. What we've learned, and the sad truth is that background and resources matter. So it's not surprising that somebody I'm a white cisgender male. I came from some means. It's not surprising that I was able to get identified fairly young. But I know, and we see it still today, that if my race, my gender, my financial means had been different, then the possibility that both the willingness of my family to identify me and also the resources to either do it or to advocacy to do it would just be different. So if you look at the national statistics, and depending on literally geography or the family you were born into, it might be different. So we'll see over and under representation, city by city, town by town. But what we know is that what I actually love about neurodiversity is that it affects everyone. I think we talk a lot in our society these days about how different we all are. And one of the things I've loved about neurodiversity is I've seen across America and the world, neurodiversity is everywhere, and it's something that we can find love across. And maybe I sit in a unique position. I think I do that I get to see that, but it gives me a lot of hope in this world. To your other question, yes, there's emerging research around the gifts that come from being neurodiverse. And I'm actually working on my second book currently, which is going to be around neurodiversity in the workplace, because what we know is that once we help kids get through school, these different ways of seeing the world are hugely advantageous to the work world. And I would argue, and it's what we've done here at Eye to Eye, is no team should, if you're trying to build a successful team, no team should fail to include somebody who's neurodiverse, because they're going to see something slightly different than everybody else. And that's going to be important. Maybe not the right or wrong answer, but just to be able to see the whole picture. And I can give you some great stories about stuff I've learned if you're curious. I don't know how much time we have, or we can do it in person when we're together in a month.
Well, your stories that you will bring here to Park City on August 17th at 5 p.m. It's actually a free event, the Joseph James Morelli Foundation event. It's the 10-year anniversary of that foundation, and they have granted scholarships to so many kids around the country, in Park City and all around the country. It's just a wonderful organization that we can be proud of here in Park City, that it exists. So we'll hear more about that on the local news hour in a couple of weeks. They'll be talking more details. But again, that event is on August 17th. So we were talking before we went on air about how kids, at least when I was in elementary school, and I don't know how long this, I'm hoping this doesn't exist anymore. If you go in, you're a new student in school, your placement in what math group you are, what, you know, reading group you are, everything is determined by you reading aloud to the teacher. That's how it was when I was in school. So what if you have a brilliant math mind, but you're dyslexic? By reading one paragraph aloud, you're going to get put in the low math group if you can't read aloud. What a disconnect, right? How has that changed now with your young kids? How do they do that quick assessment?
I have good news and bad news for you. So, I mean, the good news is, yes, things have changed. And we work nationally, so I have an interesting sort of point of view and perspective on what I get to see happening all across America. And the bad news is that things can be very specific to where you live. So there are national standards, and in some of those cases that does help determine where people end up. But the reality is a lot can really be determined on what specifically is happening in your school and school district and what resources your school district has. My kids happen to go to a fairly well-resourced school district. So even if you kind of get put in a track early on that would indicate that you might be struggling, the point of being in that track in the school district that we're in is to get you out of that track. However, that's not always the case, and they don't always have the resources to do that. So it's why, in the end of the day, your education is your education. And as much as, you know, we'd love to kind of, I think, feel in the commitment that we've made to kids, which is to say we're going to send them to school and they're all going to have a chance to thrive, they do have that chance, but it does require a family's investment to kind of keep checking in every day. How's it going? How can I help? That doesn't mean you have to be an expert teacher. I'm a trained teacher, and I still struggle with how to support my kids in some of the specific academics because I'm not trained in elementary education, which is where they're at. So it really just requires a thoughtful parent to be able to ask those questions and to let them know that you're there for them. Like my mom mm-hmm. did back in the 80s. It wasn't because she was a teacher she was able to help me. It's because she was a parent who was willing to listen.
That's you're mentioning a couple times about how the disparity in availability of care could affect the way people move forward with a diagnosis or treatment. One of the things I was really appreciating reading about your Eye to Eye Foundation or organization is this mentoring program. I bet that's such a support for people who, for whatever reason, don't have a lot of guidance or role models or whatever. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, it's why this, you know, partnership with the Morelli Foundation is so wonderful, because the reality is there's a ton of reasons why kids struggle and continue to struggle through school. And one of the reasons is financially. So, you know, can we make sure that they can make it through? And the other reason is at some point, actually, parents can't be the only people cheering on their kids. And if you do it right early on, you're able to have other people, and we provide that. So we make sure that right, really specifically in middle school and high school, for those listening who have middle schoolers or high schoolers, you know that is a tough time. It's really when kids are appropriately starting to separate from their families and create a sense of independence. That's when we step in. So we make sure that, you know, as kids are starting to look for community outside of just their family unit, they find us. So we train high school and college age mentors and how to be good role models, and they will invest back in their community. So working with younger kids, it's in a group setting. And we actually have a new program in addition to our mentoring program called the Neurodiversity Alliance. Because what we realize is you don't just have to be neurodiverse mentoring someone who's neurodiverse to understand that it sometimes just requires somebody there to sometimes quite literally give you a hug, and other times, you know, sort of emotionally say, I'm here for you. The power of someone saying, I'm here for you is tremendous.
It is tremendous.
I would say to even anyone listening today, they've never met me. Today might be the first time they've ever heard my voice. I'm here for you. Y'all should know that. That's why our organization exists, both in person and as an idea. We understand what it's like to struggle, and we can tell you there's a bright story ahead. And we can tell you that with authenticity. We've all struggled and we've all gotten through it. In fact, everyone that works at Eye to Eye has had that journey. And I know that's why you've chosen today to spend this time with me having this conversation, because I can feel y'all here for me. So we really do better together as a community, and that's what we're all about here.
Oh, that's wonderful. Fostering that empathy is a huge part. How would somebody who might want to get involved with the Neurodiversity Alliance do that?
Yeah, thank you for asking. It's super easy. You just go to our website. You can go to the Neurodiversity Alliance, or you can go to eyetoeyenational.org. Either way, you'll find a way to quickly sign up. We send you immediately some information about how to, start making change in your community locally today. We realize that, everyone, I think, in their best of intentions wants to make a difference, and we just want to give you the tools to do it.
That's wonderful. Well, we're looking so forward to having you come to Park City on August 17th. Well, I did hear a story, and I won't spoil it, but about something your father did for you to help you along your journey. And he's a radio guy with a great voice. So back to the audible thing, I have noticed that many of us, since we can now listen to podcasts, we can now listen to books on Audible, that a lot of adults are discovering a lot about themselves in terms of their learning styles. And I just wondered if you might comment on that. Like, people say now, oh, all I do is listen to books. I wish I had known this when I was young.
Well, Lynn, I definitely have to tell the story about my dad when I come visit. So there's a teaser. You want to learn about Dave's dad? Come on August 16th, 17th. I'll tell you. I'm in Vegas today. I've been doing an ironic residency here. I've been here for 2 weeks. I did go back home to be with my daughter for her birthday. But when I was here last week, I was giving a talk. About 4,000 people were there. And it was a general education talk. So it was unusual. In some respects, they invited me to give a talk, because I often speak about the 20%, those who are neurodiverse. But I was really happy that they gave me that platform to speak to the general ed audience. And I began my talk with this, they said, be provocative, which I don't really know how not to be. So I was like, great, you're going to get what you paid for. And so I began my talk with, I believe it is as valuable to read with your ears as it is to read with your eyes. And I could feel that this was the whole moment. I was either going to lose 4,000 people and never get invited back to Vegas. I'm here, so I guess it worked out. Or really try and explain, to your point, Lynn, like, what does that mean? And I think, we have to embrace the world that we live in. And thankfully, we live in a world where there's lots of ways to get knowledge. And reading has forever been a way in which we share knowledge. And for a long time, the idea that you could read with your ears as accessibly as read with your eyes, that was impossible. When I was a kid, it was much more difficult to do. And yes, people are saying all the time, oh, I'm so glad that audiobooks exist. I listen to books on the way to work. And, as adults, we consume even the news these days. You can have things read to you. But it is a fundamental belief that we have to start to analyze. I don't disagree that you need to learn to read with your eyes. There are times when that's super valuable. But if you can process really fast with your ears, reading or information, that is also incredibly valuable. I think we need to hone in a new skill, which is actually how to tune out all the information coming into our face, whether that be through your eyes, your ears, through your cell phone. Having ADHD as well, I'll tell you, it's an extra challenge that I'm learning to live through, as I know we all are, even if you don't have ADHD. So pluses and minuses in this world as it changes. But if we can push away beliefs, or at least put them aside enough to say, wait, why do we think that reading one way is valid and another way is not? That gives us the opportunity to really be inclusive and to invite people, regardless of how they learn best, to learn. And that's the point of school. And that's really the point of life. I think you're born, you start learning. I love watching babies learn. And my 93-year-old grandfather, God bless him, before he passed away, I can tell you he was the most curious person I ever met. He was always learning, and I really think that's what it is to be human.
Absolutely. Well, what a great comment to wrap up this interview on. David Flink, he is our guest. He's the founder and the chief empowerment officer of Eye to Eye. It's a national nonprofit that deals with learning identities, different learning identities. And we've been talking about dyslexia mostly today. And David will be coming to town on August 17th. So David, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Oh, I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful that the Morelli Foundation is inviting me to come. It's going to be a really special time together.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
Park City has a strong connection to its past, from the mining history that defined our beginnings to those who took a chance at this once rundown mining town to carve out a place to live and enjoy the mountains, back when enjoying the mountains happened on a few ski runs in the winter and not much the rest of the year. Our guest this morning is someone who helped create and pave the way from that past to the present. He still contributes, and he's joining us now in the studio. It's Jan Wilking. He's a longtime community leader, business person, and co-founder of Mountain Trails Foundation, among many other things that we hope to hear about. He joins us as the first in a new series we're doing about how the past paved the way to the present and why we should acknowledge these elements so we don't lose what makes this mountain town so special. Jan Wilking, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jan.
Hi, Jay.
Great to have you.
Yes.
Great to be here. Well, let's start, Jan, with the beginning for you. When did you move to Park City? And give us an idea of what this town was like and why you moved here to begin with.
Well, I moved to Park City in 1969. I was going to school and teaching at the University of Utah. And my girlfriend had, I went to Montana State University, and she was 1 year behind, and she came down to Salt Lake. And I ski raced when I was young, and I got to experience many different resort communities, and I always wanted to live in a resort community. So when she came down to live in Utah, we drove up to Park City, and it was a very, very different place. A lot of the buildings on Main Street were boarded up. There were vacant lots all the way up and down Main Street. Well, there were 3 part-time real estate agents, and that's it. That's it. And so now there's 1,000. Well, we walked into one of the real estate office on Main Street and asked about rentals. And so Mike Ivers, a longtime local, grabbed this key ring. He said, well, let me show you some places. So we went to this house up on Marsac Avenue, actually right across from City Hall, a little bit above that. And he said, it's a 4-bedroom house, all the linens, TVs, silverware, beds, everything comes with it. And we said, okay, great. Well, how much is it? And he said, $100 a month. And so that's what Park City was like back then. You know, the last building in town is the building right next to U.S. Bank. It was the telephone building at the time. There's only one other building between Park City, that building, and Kimball Junction, and that was what was called Streets Filling Station, which is now, was a Top Stop.
Yeah.
Top Stop. Uh-huh. That was the last building all the way to the junction. There was one farm out at the canyons, you know, right next to Park West there. So,
it's
very different.
Very different. You know, when we think of the ski resort towns or the mountain towns that have been around for a long time, I think our attention turns more to places like Sun Valley that were kind of glitzy back in the 50s and, you know, even Jackson Hole. But I don't think that we think of Park City, and I think you're explaining why. There just was nothing here.
Well, there were 12,000 people in town. The mines were shutting down. They were struggling. The resort had been here for a couple years, but I think we had a gondola, a tea bar, and maybe two chairlifts possibly. And it didn't really attract much attention back then. Like you say, Sun Valley and Jackson and Aspen were well known, but Park City wasn't. And so it was kind of a sleepy little town at that time. So
yeah,
it's great.
Well, Jan, we probably need 2 hours, honestly, to discuss everything that you've done to that has made an impact on what the community is today. But maybe chat a little bit with us about, you know, what you've done from a journalism perspective, you know, with the Park Record.
Okay. Well, first got involved in journalism through purchasing a paper in town that was called the Park City Coalition. Myself, Steve Deering, Greg Scherf, and Hank Lewis all formed a partnership and purchased a paper that actually Jan Peterson was a partner in at the time. And we thought it'd be something great to do. The Park Record was obviously here for a very long time, and we were competing with that. So the four of us, well, one thing that was very fortunate is that we bought several pieces, or two pieces of property on Main Street and one on Park Avenue at the same time we purchased the newspaper. Well, we soon came to realize that we couldn't live on, you know, the newspaper. There was no way that we'd make enough money to support all of us. So we traded two of the pieces of real estate to Hank and Greg, and Steve and I continued to do the newspaper. Let's see, in 1979, I believe it was, that Steve was offered the job of being the first marketing director at Deer Valley. And he said, if you were me, what would you do? I said, I'd take the job in a second. I mean, how can you pass that up? Yeah. At that time, I was the publisher, and Steve wasn't really involved in the paper. Tina Minch was part of it, and David Hampshire. And actually, when David was editor, we brought Rick Bruff up from Salt Lake City. He was with us, and Conrad Elliott. Many, many great people that I got to work with. Well, having two newspapers in town, you know, just weren't working economically. So I was able to get the owners of the Park Record to merge into my paper. But we decided to keep the name the Park Record because of the history. So that's my first involvement. Now, I'm not a journalist. I can't write. We were talking earlier how I'm very dyslexic. I can't spell. So I came into journalism from the business side as a publisher and would hire editors and writers and photographers and all of that. So that was my first involvement.
Well, and then you ended up getting involved in, you know, where we are today with the internet. I mean, I think, did you not own ParkCity.com originally?
You know, it was something that, you know, I read that and I went, God, did I? That's a problem.
This guy's done so
it was
much,
so
he
long
know
ago.
What
yeah,
he owned,
I had an involvement with it. It was actually with a group out of South Carolina, Myrtle Beach, and they actually had the name, but they asked me to get involved with them. So I didn't actually create that name or first own it, but I was working with a group that had that. And I worked with them for quite a while, but then it just, they had problems with their partnership, and it just kind of dissolved, and I continued to have the newspaper.
Yeah. So what was your degree in from, was it, you said Montana State?
Yes, I actually have a master's degree in architecture, Montana State. And when I first came to Park City, well, trying to think, first I was working at the Timber House, which Matt Alvarez and Helen Alvarez.
Oh, yeah.
I had a store at the bottom of, it was actually on Park Avenue, but at the bottom of Main Street. And so worked with them, and this was when I was still going to school and teaching there at the U. And so I worked with them, and then worked with Edgar Stern at Greater Park City Company. And one of my jobs was a liaison between Greater Park City Company and the city council. And having experienced these other resort communities and seeing how they changed and what they were going through, I realized that Park City was not ready for what was going to happen.
Right. So, what made you take a chance on Park City. I mean, it was pretty ragged back in those days. Even when I moved to town, I think 17 years later, as if my math is correct, it was so different. And it was a little bit of taking a chance on this place that a lot of other people throughout the West and in other mountain towns kind of poo-pooed, shall we say.
Well, one thing that I really enjoyed is it being a small community. And there was such a sense of community, as we were talking earlier, that everyone had to come to the post office to get their mail. And so you would see just about everyone in town each morning as you went in to get your mail. And it developed such a sense of community that, and also having watched these other resort communities, I had a good sense of what was going to be happening. So that's what really attracted me to Park City.
So. Well, let's skip forward in something that's near and dear to everyone's heart, which are the trails here in Park City in the summer months and in the winter as well. But you, tell us a little bit about how mountain trails came to be and your involvement with that in the early days of that organization.
Sure, I'd be happy to. This would be early on, there were a lot of pirated trails being cut. Mm-hmm. And one of the places where trails were being cut was on Park City Mountain Resort. Phil Jones was president at the time, and he came across someone cutting a trail, and he said, "You can't do that." And this person said, "Go screw yourself. I can do whatever I want." And like I say, I know. So you can imagine those people who know Phil Jones will know how he reacted. He didn't do anything against the person there, but he went to his office, called me as president of the Chamber Bureau and said, "I'm going to have to shut all access to the mountain." And I said, "Look, let's see if we can come up with a solution." And I was publishing a magazine called Bicycle Utah Vacation Guides at the time, and I really sensed that bicycling was going to be an important component of what we would offer in the community. So I said, "Phil, let's see what we can do." And at first, before we put together mountain trails, what I'd do is organize a gathering at Deer Valley, and Deer Valley would donate the food, and Greg Scherf would donate all the beer, and I'd let people know that it's free beer and free food, and every mountain biker in town showed up on the deck at Deer Valley. And so we did that for 2 years in a row, and then I realized we just needed to do more, and a lot of it had to do also with trail etiquette. It was starting to be some real problems on the trails, that there just wasn't the proper etiquette. And it was because people just didn't understand what they needed to do, how to behave on trails. So I got together a group of people, who was like Tom Clyde and Tim Henney and Charlie Sturgis and Sally Elliott and a person from the Chamber Bureau, and we decided to form an organization. And Tom wrote the articles of incorporation and filed them. And that's kind of how we formalized it. And the good thing is that we were able to keep our trails open on Park City Mountain Resort. And Deer Valley was cutting trails at the time. Don Taylor was also on that very first board. I'm probably leaving some people out that I just don't
You'll
remember
hear,
now.
You will hear from later.
Yeah, hopefully our listeners are taking notes, because there are a lot of names in here that really helped pave the way for where we are riding today.
True. And, the board, one of the things I convinced the board early on is that there's going to be burnout, volunteer burnout, that we can put all of the effort in, but eventually it's just going to, we just aren't going to do the job that we need to do. And so I convinced them that we need to hire an executive director. But we had no money at all. But fortunately, a couple years earlier, we'd the community decided to put a 1% sales tax on restaurants. And I happen to be on the Restaurant Sales Tax Advisory Committee, and so we made an application to the committee to hire a half-time executive director and pay him $12,000 a year. So we put some ads in the paper, and Troy Duffin saw an ad. He was an attorney in the Tahoe area at the time doing land use work and applied for the job. And we had many great applications, but Troy certainly stood out at that time. And he said, yeah, I want to come here and do this. I want to come back to Utah. So we hired him as our first executive director. And that really is what got Mountain Trails going.
Yeah. So, and if I recall correctly, it went when Troy started, and that's really what you needed was a land use attorney to start working through easements on private property and things like that, because you couldn't just, you know, like they did before, you couldn't just go cut trails and ask, you know, for forgiveness later. He was crucial. I remember in the scope of about, well, it was funny because it was when I had one of my kids, and I don't remember which one, it would depend on the year, but so I was sort of away from the trails for about a year or two. And there were 10 miles of trails before, and after I came back, there were suddenly 100 miles. And that was what Troy really was able to, you know, to boast and to say,
he
wow.
He was instrumental in building what is now the Mid-Mountain Trail. That was the start, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing that Troy was so good at is that at the time, developers weren't in favor of trails. They didn't view it as an amenity. They thought that people who were they were selling, say, subdivision lots to wouldn't want to be near a trail. And so Troy would go to all of the county planning commission meetings and the city planning commission meetings saying, look, you need to have a trail. A dedicated public access trail through your development. And Troy was very good at that. It's great to see how each executive director that we had kind of fit the need at the time. And Troy was a perfect person for those first 10 years, I think it was. And then it was time for someone a little bit more mellow. And that's when Carol Potter was hired.
Yeah.
And Carol did a great job, and then Charlie followed her, did a fabulous job, and now we have Laura, which is
fantastic.
I mean, each one had a role, and Laura's doing a fabulous job and raising a lot of money and has great staff, and you know, to have a full-time trails care crew is not typical.
You know, as you've been talking, Jan. And by the way, if you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Jan Wilking. It's the first in a new series we're doing on sort of connecting the past to the present and honoring and acknowledging those people who have really paved the way to make this town what it is today. Jan, as you've been talking, I noticed that most of the names that you have mentioned, those kind of first community leaders, unless they have passed away, and some of them have, they're still here. And it makes me wonder about when you invest in a community and you know, you volunteer in organizations and you put in your application to become a planning commissioner or you run for city council or county council, it anchors your commitment to your community. And I think that that's maybe why people do it and maybe why all these names that you talked about from way back when, they're all still here.
Yeah. And it's great. The people that were involved back in the early days of Park City, many of them have stayed here and are still very involved in our community. And one thing that's nice is that, you know, we don't have to repeat mistakes of the past, hopefully, because of that. But there are, you know, are so many, well, one thing, there were so many opportunities to get involved in the community then. And there weren't that many people, whether it's a planning commission or you know, the city council.
Hence why you were on all the boards. It seemed pretty easy to get things done back then. He would just ask himself if he wanted some money.
a couple of weeks ago, my wife said to me, you know, when we first got together 30 plus years ago, that I would go to a meeting every single night of the week.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the way people were. They were very civic-minded and very willing to get involved. And that's just the way the community was. So it was great. But, you know, in the early days, there was also this division in the community between the miners and the new people in town. Many of the younger people in town, as you know, the Vietnam War was still going, and a lot of the people, it was interesting, everyone had a nickname. And I realized later it's because they didn't want their real name known because they were avoiding the war.
Oh.
And so everyone from steakhouse to dumbwaiter to ski boy, all of them just had nicknames, you know. And at that time, it was called the Alamo, and everyone hung out at the Alamo, and that was right across from the post office. And but people really did get involved, and it's great to see those people stay that, like you say, haven't passed away or still involved in the community.
Yeah.
If you could wave a wand and change something for, let's say, for the better, you know, in the community that you could have done early on that would still be moving forward, is there something that you would do?
Well, you know, a lot of the things, you know, that I wanted to do, I did at that time.
Right.
And, you know, obviously the growth has occurred very rapidly. You know, the difficulties, say, with traffic are certainly something that I wish we could somehow solve. But just based on our geography, that's very, very difficult. You know, the cost of housing is, you know, it's happening everywhere in the country. It's not just here. In fact, I think we're making some good attempts at trying to solve it. I like Mountainlands Housing is doing a great job. And so people are addressing the problems, trying to deal with them. Child care, obviously. But what's great is that we do have new people in the community that are really working on these problems. But those are three of the things that would be good if we maybe address them earlier. That would be one thing that I'd hope we would do.
Mm-hmm.
So,
are you still getting out? And I mean, are you skiing still? Are you out on the trails? And how are you recreating nowadays?
Well, I don't ski any longer. I 12 years ago was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, cancer of the plasma cells. Well, I still have several tumors in my body, but a very large one on my iliac bone that has really compromised my iliac bone. And so I've not skiing, and I've skied so much all of my life, you know, including teaching skiing professionally. But I'm biking a lot, and in fact, I'm really starting to get back on my bike. We have a trip to France. We're going to bike in Normandy and Provence.
Fantastic.
Coming up in September, and we're trying to do it at least every other year now, and I think now I have plenty of time, so we'll be going at least once a year, and I just love it.
Are you riding the analog bike? Have you switched over to the dark side of electric?
I've switched. That one of the other products of having cancer, and I had two stem cell transplants, and with that comes a great deal of chemo, and that I don't know how many, 6 or 8 years of pretty heavy duty chemo has really changed my stamina. And so I switched to an electric bike probably 5 years ago. And in Europe, I ride on an electric bike, and it's great if you get caught in a rainstorm or you have a big hill or a big headwind. I've enjoyed riding an electric bike. And
it's just good to be out on bikes.
Oh, biking is probably my biggest passion these days, more than skiing, where skiing was great back then. But
yeah.
I just trying to get ready for our upcoming trip and looking forward to go take the whole family, Katie and her husband over with us. Awesome. So it's going to be great.
That's wonderful. Yeah, the e-bike, what a game changer for people. It's really nice.
You know, it's some people kind of equate it to shaped skis, that it just lets you experience this sport that much, more. And plus for people who are making their living in biking, like tour operators and that, you've just expanded your possible user so greatly.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, you know, a lot of people who have been around for a long time constantly contemplate where to move. Like, it feels like it's no longer their town, for example. And then they start thinking about where they would move. And then some of them worry, like, well, I don't want to be the part of the problem somewhere else. And sure. I love to talk to people who say, no, Park City is my place. Good, bad, ugly, wonderful, whatever it is, it's changing and evolving. I still need to be part of that here. What, you know, have you ever considered leaving, and what keeps you here?
Well, I have so many, great memories, but also great friends. Mm-hmm. We have a group that about, 10 or so of us that get together every Friday for lunch. It's a lot of people have been involved in the city, like Bob Richard and, Miles, and a lot of past city council people and past county commissioners. And so every Friday we get together for lunch, and it's that's one of the things that just keeps me so attached. Recently I thought, God, maybe, I'd live in Europe for a while. I really enjoy different cultures. And that would be one thing. The other resort communities certainly appeal to me. I travel to a lot of them still. I have very good friends. Like in Jackson, I go every summer because a friend of mine was the publisher of the newspaper and the magazines there. And so I get to experience them. And, Park City has the greatest appeal to me. And part of it is that Salt Lake is so close. To just go down to an international airport, or in my case, having the Huntsman Cancer Institute 35 minutes away has made a major difference in my life. If I lived in a Steamboat or Sun Valley, it would be long, long commutes.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, we have time for one quick question, Jay. What's burning there that we haven't heard Jan say?
Well, I just want to know, what do you see as your, crown jewel that you accomplished in all your efforts to make Park City what it is?
Well, several of them, come to mind. One is the, Mountain Trails Foundation. Also getting involved in the city council early in the 70s. We rewrote all of the comprehensive plan and zoning laws and that. One that I've actually been affiliated for 50 plus years is the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District.
Oh, yeah.
Sewer District.
Wow.
That I created that with the county commission and the city council, and have been chairman of that.
I'm telling you, we need another hour.
Yeah, we do. We do. Well,
I'd love to tell you more stories.
Jan Wilking, what a pleasure it is to have you join us in the studio and to tell us some of these stories. It's really important to our community. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jan.
Thank you, guys. And look forward to this series.